All right, Greg, how do you gather a crew?
Well, how you gather a crew for this type of operation is kind of tough in one way, because it's not like a lot of people have done it. There have been a few companies that have, but basically what I did is I brought some of my former crew from when we were working in Haiti and other places. I brought them forward into this because they had been with me for years and years, and so they know, you know, they know basically what I know. And then we hired some other people, and basically what we look for is, you know, good background, because we have to live together aboard ship, work ethic, and talents. And we went through, you know, at one time we had 20, 21 people on board ship. And then we started weeding them out because we didn't need them. But the ones that we kept, we considered them all part of a family. And they seemed to work out well.
You trust everyone on board?
I trusted every single one of them at the time when they came aboard.
Were their hearts in it as much as you were?
I think so. I think that their hearts were in it, and they were simple people. I mean, they weren't super greedy like we have some video interviews that that Charlie did that and Ashley did that, and one of them wanted to buy their, you know, fix their mother's kitchen up, or one of them wanted to buy a new pickup truck or something like that. And their shares were going to be could have been up to $8 to $10 million or more. And so they most of them were from Maine, and I just think that Maine people have a different work ethic and a different kind of honesty. So I kind of like that. So that's how I wanted most of my crew to be.
Describe a moment where you almost bonded or you were really excited while you were on the ship.
Well, I remember that day really, really well. The day we actually saw the Port Nicholson for the first time on camera. We had bought a new ROV, remote operated vehicle. And basically what that was, it was a inspection class vehicle. It wasn't made to do heavy tasks, but what we wanted to do is get down there and try to see if we could see the cargo. And once we saw the cargo and verified it, then money wouldn't have been an issue because, you know, if you see it and you prove it's there, then, you know. But it was in the evening. One evening we were out there on site, and we got set up with the four-way anchoring system, which took us a little while to do because it was a rough spot out there. But we got the four-way anchoring set up. We've got the ship in place, and we put the ROV overboard and sent it down. And we knew where the wreck was somewhere below us because we because of a side scan survey that we had done. So the ROV was down there going back and forth trying to locate the wreck. And the ROV trailer was full of eyeballs. Everybody was staring at the screen. And then all of a sudden, it came up and turned, and there was a wall of steel with incrustations and plant life on there and sea anemones and things like that. And there it was. And we're going like, there it is! And we're all screaming and stuff. And the ROV stopped, panned its camera up to look up the side of it. And it was awesome to see that the wreck lay in there. And as soon as it panned up, the lights started dimming on it. The lights went out and the camera died. And the alarms went off. And so we had to manually hand pull it back up. And it was brand new and from the factory. And we paid, I don't know, $250,000 for it. They forgot to put O-rings in around the camera. And when it went down there, the pressure forced the water into the system and short-circuited it. We weren't very happy about that, I can tell you, because it took them 6 weeks during prime salvage time in the summer to get that fixed. They sent up a tech. We went back to Boston. They sent up a tech to start working on it. Well, a lot of parts had to be replaced. So they had to send after them, wait for them to be made. So we sat 6 weeks in Boston waiting for this ROV, the only tool we had to look at it to be fixed. And since day one, that ROV has been nothing but trouble. It's failed on us. We put another $100,000 in upgrades in it, and their recommendations, new thrusters, new everything, and it still failed.
Did you go back down?
Oh, we spent many times going back down. Sometimes we'd be down there with the ROV, and it would run for hours and hours and days with no problems. And then all of a sudden, thrusters would seize up, and we'd replace the thruster, and another one would seize up. And we're going, like, what the hell? We spent so much time repairing that. We bought a five-way manipulator arm for it so we could pick things up on the ocean floor. We had to wait for that to come from Scotland. So we got that, put that on there. That's how we picked up the ship's compass and some of the artifacts that we did bring up. But we had major problems with the ROV and from day one. And even to this day, it's not worth the money to put it together. Yes, yes, yeah. No matter what we did, it's just we repaired it and spent so much money. And that wasn't even the biggest thing. The biggest thing was the loss of time. Because out on the Port Nicholson site, it's a real strange area. You have winds from the south-southeast coming through there. You have currents coming down from every different direction. I mean, it's very turbulent area out there. So you don't have that many days to work. We'd go out there, the NOAA Weather Service would say 3 to 4 feet. That's what the seas were out there. We'd go out there, there'd be 12 to 15 feet. so we had a lot of weather delays, tons of them.
How you guys worked really well to overcome those things, because the coolest thing I got to see was how you guys couldn't get that big ROV to work, so what you did was you rigged up the drop crane thingy there to drop the weighted basket down.
Oh, yeah.
And the tube system that brought up the smaller ROV, which we saw there.
Yeah.
Just right. Talk about how the reason why, even with other setbacks, you guys still managed to persevere, find solutions, and keep moving forward, you know, regardless.
Right. When our ROV failed all the time, we were out there, so, you know, it took us 10 hours, 11 hours to get to the site, another couple hours to hook up the four-way anchoring system, and if the weather was good, we just didn't want to come back. So we did have we bought a small ROV called a Video Ray, and it was basically a throwaway type of an ROV, meaning that if you lost it, you wouldn't lose $250,000, you'd lose $35,000. So we set it up, we'd figure out a way to get something down there to look at it. And one day, as a matter of fact, we was out there and the ROV was giving us, the bigger ROV was giving us lots of problems. So we hooked up the small ROV to a big chain link from the chain, and we threw that over the side, which yanked that little one down, and the current was so strong, it flung it up over the wreck, and it ended up going right into the cargo bay that we've always wanted to get into. Not far enough to get into where we needed to get into, but it was in there a ways, and we flew it around for a while. Then it took another 2 hours to get the cord untied from the wreckage because there's so much debris down there wrapped around everything. And I really didn't want to lose our stuff because we didn't really have enough money to go out and buy, you know, another half dozen of these things to throw away. So we tried to preserve what we had, but we always figured out a way to get things done, and it took time. But while this was all going on, we knew that we couldn't salvage the wreck with the equipment we had after a period of time out there. So one of our guys, Robert Mueller, he was hired. And what he did is he went out and tried to get some other bigger companies, like oil companies that had this kind of equipment, to work with us. And this was back during a few years ago when oil prices were through the roof. So all their equipment was being used because they were making millions of dollars a day with just their equipment. And to come up here to take it all from the Gulf of Mexico or off of Brazil or someplace like that and ship it all the way to Boston, it was cost prohibitive. I mean, we got a quote on one work-class ROV. They wanted $1 million a week to come up here. And that didn't matter if the weather was bad and you couldn't get out there. It was $1 million a week. We couldn't afford it. So we had to work with what we had while we tried to find someone to work with us.
How would your friends and family describe you during this time?
Enthusiastic. They, my my wife, my daughters and stuff, and friends. I was very enthused about this because it was that it was my whole life. When I was in Louisiana, I was gone for 6 months. I thought it was only going to be a couple months working on the ship. Well, it was 6 months, and I got home a few times, but just a couple of times. So I was excited about it all. I wanted to get back here and get the job done, but I was gone a lot. But I stayed enthusiastic, even though it was, you know, you're away from your family a lot. But I did whatever it took, and it was a huge project because we did almost $1 million worth of renovations on the ship when we got it. I got them to throw in a 100-ton A-frame, which cost, if you had to replace it, was $1.5 million. I got the shipyard to give it to us. Of course, when they gave it to us, we got put it on the ship. We had to bolt it down, weld it into place, get new hydraulics for it and everything else. So everything took longer than we thought. And when we first got the ship and I put fuel aboard, it was 50 cents a gallon or 55 cents a gallon. When we got back here and around up into Boston, it was $4 a gallon. So the cost of everything went out of sight. Everything. Dockage. You'd think that dockage would be, you know, reasonable. We brought the ship to Portland. They wanted $6,500 a month to tie the ship up here in Portland. And I'm going, $6,500 a month? That's a little steep. So I found a dock space down in East Boston for $800 a month. So I did the math. I mean, I could make a lot of trips to Massachusetts on the difference between $800 and $6,500.
So you made it work. You would find a solution to keep...
No matter what it was, you had to find a solution to make things happen because, like I said, there was no book that said, you know, open to page 10 about your hydraulics. You just didn't have that. It was all, you know, we were building something custom-made to do a custom job.
Through all this, did you ever doubt it was there?
No, I never doubted it. I never doubted there was a cargo aboard the Port Nicholson that was valuable. And if anybody asked me, do you guarantee it's aboard? I never guaranteed it. I said, I'm 99% sure that it is. In my heart and soul, it was 99%. You have to leave that 1% because I could be sitting back here painting the ship and someone went out there and stole it. You know, some government or some other company or whatever. I didn't think that was going to happen, but you always just leave that 1% there because nothing is guaranteed in life.
Well, seeing how this has all played out, it doesn't seem that far-fetched, actually.
I know.
Can you talk about the moment things started turning bad for you?
Yeah. Well, when things started going downhill, we had one partner that... He knew what kind of because he had called a lot and wanted updated information and stuff. And we explained to him what we really needed to do this job. We needed a work class ROV with tools to cut through the hull and go inside the ship. And he told me that he had some people that had all the money that would ever be needed to do this right, and they were willing to get in. But he had to put together a package to present to them, and he was willing to do that. He says, but I need as much information as you can give me. I says, so what I did is I turned him over to my researcher in Massachusetts after I gave him what I thought he wanted. And I think he wanted a little bit more. So I told my researcher in Mass, this guy is going to call you. And I said, give him whatever he needs, whatever we have, give it to him because he's going to help us. Well, come to find out, this guy started his own company called Mission Recovery. And he was a partner in this. He had signed the agreement, non-compete, all of this kind of stuff. He started his own company quietly called Mission Recovery. And the idea was to take the wreck away from us, come to court and take the wreck away from us and salvage it himself. And I'm going like, wow. This is after the British guy and some of the partners were talking and trying to get the wreck away from me behind my back. Then this guy comes up. And is doing the same thing. And then I find out that the partners that talked to the British guy and this guy all started talking together, but this guy was so greedy, the other guys didn't want anything to do with him. So it's turning into a nightmare, and they're all doing it behind my back, thinking that they can do it, whereas we didn't get it done fast enough, that they could do it, and they would get the bulk of it. So it started going to hell really fast. And then come one point, my researcher sent me up a couple of documents. They were kind of smoking gun documents. I mean, it basically said that there was 4,700 and something gold ingots on board and all of this stuff. I mean, right, boom, boom. I mean, a magical document that said what was on board the Port Nicholson. Where did they come from? You know, I was amazed when he emailed them to me. And I'm saying, wow, this is like unbelievable. These are what we've been waiting for through this whole thing. And I asked him, where did you get them? And he said, well, I got them from a guy named John McCann. And he was worked for the Naval Intelligence. He was retired from it, but he worked, you know, covertly and all of this stuff. And he got a hold of them. And he said that he got them from the National Archives down in Washington. And I said, wow. So I was wicked excited about it for a while. And I sent them to my lawyer down in Florida, and I sent them down in an email the way I got them. But I said, these are for your eyes only, because I didn't, you know, we had to absorb all of this and figure out what we're going to do with these documents. And so he turned them into the court. He filed them with the court. And, you know, I had to listen to him because he was the maritime attorney. I didn't know what, you know, what the laws are or anything. I just assumed that he had to do that. Have to do it, but he did it anyways. And so I think it was like a month or so later. We couldn't verify the source. So we filed with the court, and we told the court that we couldn't verify the source or verify these documents, so we don't want the court to depend on them in any way whatsoever until we could find out for sure. So it wasn't like, you know, we kept them in there and tried to scam anybody. We didn't. What we did is we did our due diligence. We got them. My attorney turned them in. I tried to verify them. We couldn't after a period of time, so we told the court that we couldn't verify them, to pull them until we could, which the court agreed. All right, and later on, of course, they came out like we had these documents and we're showing them to everybody, and, you know, we kept it going for a long time. That did not happen. And, you know, if anybody has any sense, they can go to the court. They can look at when the documents were filed and when we filed the motion to pull them back out, because we couldn't verify them. So that wasn't a very long time in between that. So there was no trying to scam anybody with these things. It was, this is how it happened. So we're still trying to find out where they came from. Or this guy, you know, where did they actually come from? Anyways, so some of the partners and stuff requested to talk to the researcher, which I said, there's no problem. I'm not, you know, we're not hiding anything. And at that time, I still didn't trust our researcher. I did. I backed him up because he had no reason that I could be aware of. He never got any bonuses or anything. I paid him to do some research, and it wasn't that much. So, I mean, there was no big payments to him of any type. And then what we did, we dug as far as we could into these documents. And my partners down in Massachusetts had said that they wanted these, you know, more substantial proof of them. So our researcher went down to the archives. And he's down there. He sent photographs of him standing outside, sitting in there with documents and things, and with some kind of markings on them and stuff like that, and sent them to us. He was lying to us. We didn't know it at that time. What I found out afterwards basically is he was trying to sell part of his share to the Port Nicholson, because he got a share for doing the research. And he was trying to sell part of it because he was out of money. And the guy that was trying to buy it wanted more concrete proof. And thereafter, these documents appeared.
When you found out that he was lying, what did you do?
I couldn't believe it. I met with him, and he came up here in a panic. And I was up in northern Maine at my father's house. He came up here to Gorham, and he was all up in arms. He needed to talk to me immediately. Has something to do with the feds wanted to question him. And I said, he had called us like the week before, and me and Kathy were sitting here on the couch, and he said, what am I going to tell him? I said, tell him the damn truth. You went down there, and this guy gave John McCann gave you the documents. Tell them the damn truth. All right. Well, come to find out, the feds were at this time found out that Ed had made up these documents. Not Ed. Cut Ed out. My researcher had made up these documents, went to the archives, and used the archives to do this. And apparently, they went up to him, and he must have said that, or they said, we need a bigger fish than you. And so they wired him. He came up here, and they asked me, he says, well, you know that we made this up. And I said, what are you talking about? And he says, about those documents. I says, what? You made them up? He says, you knew I made them up. And I says, I kind of swore. I won't say it now, but I said, Ed, I had suspicions about these documents because nobody's been able to verify them, but I've had faith in you, and I've been protecting your ass, not protecting it. I've been backing you in this because you have never lied to me. Now you're sitting here telling me you made these up? And he said, yeah, you knew it. I said, no, I know it now because you just told me. And I was so pissed. You couldn't even understand how I felt at that moment. Because I know what that's going to cause. I know what it's going to cause. You file false documents with the court. You knew they were made up. And now you're telling them that I had something to do with it. Heartbroken, pissed. I mean, I went through every emotion. All right. Then the next weekend, I hear a pounding at my door. I go down there and open the door, and there's FBI agents. There's the Maine State Police, the Gorham Police, the archival investigators. They all got automatic weapons, pistols aimed at my head. You know, and then they come into my home. They have a search warrant. They search my whole house. They took computers, hard drives, cameras, video cameras, every document, everything that I had on the Port Nicholson, financial, everything. That was over a year. It's been, you know, 14, 15 months ago. Right, it's been to the grand jury a couple of times, and they told them they don't have enough. They took my attorney-client privilege away from me. The courts did. That's what America is built on, that you can go to your attorney and talk to him. But they took that away from me. Not that I have anything to hide. It's the principle of it. Why have they went to such lengths to silence me or to get me off of this wreck? Because if I have no documentation, I have nothing. I can't go to anybody and continue this. I have nothing. They still have all of this stuff. And they have, you know, all my financial records, everything, which I have no problem. Look through them and give them back to me. Because they're not going to find anything that I've done that is wrong. I mean, I may not have dotted an I here, or, you know, I might have spent 10 cents over here where I probably shouldn't have. But there's nothing involved in trying to scam anybody or sway anybody or nothing. It just never happened, and it just didn't.
Regardless of these documents, you still believed it was down there before. You believed there was a wreck down there. The documents happened after.
Right? Well, we went through 4 years or so of when 99% of all the partners got in prior to these documents even coming about. These documents came about in the last couple of years, within 2 years, I think it was. So everybody had already been in, and then these documents popped up, and not everybody saw them. It was just a few people that actually saw them, but my attorney filed them with the court. Of course, the newspaper got a hold of them because of the British, and the British are saying, those aren't real, and they turned out not to be. But no, they weren't used for any money raising other than our one partner down in a hedge fund down in Massachusetts saw the documents. But they also questioned my researcher personally for several hours, giving him the third degree to get as much information as they could. And they agreed with what he said, and, you know, they continued on.
When the raid happened, how were your emotions like?
When the raid happened? Yeah. I mean, I was scared shitless because, I mean, the last time I had guns pointed at me like that was when I was in Vietnam. you know, and people shoot to kill then. And, you know, I didn't know about what they were going to do and why they were even here. They could have came in here and asked me for the stuff. I would have gave it to them because I don't have anything to hide. But they came in here and raided. And then they came back again to get some other stuff. You know, it's like, why didn't you get it the first time? They had to come back again. So anyways, they've had all the stuff for 14, 15 months now. Plenty enough time to go through all of it. And if they found something, why haven't they come here? I don't know if we put that, but I don't want to invite them back. I don't want to invite them back, but I'm living with Charlie. Just kidding, Charlie.